Actually, it is a good example of how to implement HPC programming to design some special programs that can deal with a large amount of data when you use the phylogenetic reconstruction. So this is a very good task for high-performance computing, and this talk will be presented by Alexandros Stamatakis. He will present the algorithms and design of his programs RocksML and parallelly implemented version of the maximum likelihood approach for building phylogenetic tree. Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Dimitri. So I'm glad to be back here. Just do me one general favor. So if something is unclear, just ask right away and don't wait until I finish the lecture, right? So if there are questions that arise in the course of the lecture, just ask me right away. And probably I have too much material, so we won't get through all of it. I just prefer that we do some of the stuff I'm going to present thoroughly. So let's just initially have a look what we're dealing with or what the input data is. So basically, when we want to compute a phylogenetic tree, we have some DNA sequences of some organisms we're interested in. Initially, they are unaligned. So the first step we have to do when we want to compute a phylogenetic tree is that we have to build or compute a multiple sequence alignment. So this actually is a very compute-intensive and difficult problem on its own, but we will not, for the time being, we will not look at the multiple sequence alignment problem. We'll just assume that we have a good multiple sequence alignment. Then what you can do, so once you have the input data, once you have this sequence alignment, you would then just apply your phylogenetic methods to compute a phylogenetic tree. So what happens is that you have a common extinct ancestor at all inner nodes of that tree. You have some kind of timeline here, and just the currently living species which are located at the tips of that tree. So all those hairy monsters are the currently living species, and those inner nodes just represent extinct common ancestors. So just some things to remember. So what I'm not going to talk about, we don't really just need DNA or amino acid sequences as input, but we can also use gene order data. So there has been some work on algorithms and computational methods that use gene order data to infer phylogenetic trees, so this is something I'm not going to talk about. And also another thing we have to keep in mind is that the model for evolution we use or we want to infer does not necessarily need to be a tree. We might have phylogenetic networks, especially if you think about lateral gene transfer and all those kinds of effects. This is also one possible way to model evolution. So there has been some work on that. But and finally, what we need to keep in mind that the output of our phylogenetic reconstruction does not necessarily need to be a strictly bifurcating, so strictly binary tree, but we might have some multifurcating trees, which means essentially that you have some nodes from which more than three branches depart. So what we'll do in this talk here is just that we focus on the computation of strictly bifurcating phylogenetic trees under the maximum likelihood method for, well, both DNA and protein sequence data. Okay, so here's the basic outline of the talk. So I'll just give an introduction to the computation of phylogenies, then have a little closer look at the maximum likelihood method itself, and then mainly focus on how we really compute maximum likelihood trees. So the main focus is not so much on the maths, but on the computational problems that arise when you try to do phylogenetic reconstruction under maximum likelihood. So we have several issues here: search algorithms, optimization of the maximum likelihood function itself, some modeling issues, and parallelism in the maximum likelihood function, then some related topics and just a summary of future challenges. So, as I already mentioned, what we need as an input is a good multiple sequence alignment. We're not really sure, so good is really a fuzzy term. We don't really know what a good multiple sequence alignment is as an input, in particular for phylogeny reconstruction. And the output we usually get from the programs is just an unrooted binary tree. And so, evidently what we have is that there are various methods for phylogenetic inference, like fast and simple ones, neighbor joining, maximum parsimony, which is still relatively fast and still relatively simple. And then we have the more complex models that are based on an explicit statistical model of nucleotide substitution. So those are maximum likelihood and Bayesian methods. So actually what we have here First of all, is that for maximum likelihood based and Bayesian methods, we can explicitly choose our model of nucleotide substitution, which is not given by the other programs, and we have a typical kind of engineering trade-off between speed and accuracy when we compare, for example, the simpler and faster methods like neighbor joining and maximum parsimony with the more elaborate ones and computationally more intensive ones that are based on the likelihood function. So one thing is that we probably need complex methods and models to reconstruct large and complicated trees. As I already said, so the focus of this lecture will just be on maximum likelihood search algorithms and on computing the likelihood function in general, which equally applies both to maximum likelihood-based phylogenetic inference as well as to Bayesian methods. Because in Bayesian statistics, what you essentially do all the time is to execute the likelihood function. So 95% of Bayesian inference searches are actually just spent within the computation of the likelihood function. But we'll see that in more detail later on. So, well, a little bit of general motivation. So we need phylogenies to obtain insights in medical and biological research, epidemiology, virology, conservation biology, cancer. So, for example, we had one project where we worked on papillomavirus phylogenies. It's a kind of a virus that induces cervical cancer. And another very nice application is the classification of unidentified sequences. So let's just look at this one use case in a little bit more detail. So what we want to do is that, well, we have some kind of well-established phylogeny and well-established alignment from the literature where we have done some kind of taxonomic classification, and we have some unknown query sequences for which we want to find out where they belong in this reference tree. So those sequences can be, for example, from air conditioning filters, where the cells just land in the air conditioning filter and get destroyed. So we just sample DNA sequences from that filter and want to find out what kind of organisms can be found, ended up in this air conditioning filter. Another very classic and hot topic currently are microbial communities. So you just sample sequences from microbial communities, might also have some kind of time series samples, and you want to find out what kind of organisms you have or what kind of organisms are interacting within those microbial communities. And finally, a very nice example are bird strike victims. So if you have an airplane and bird just gets sucked into the aircraft engine, the poor bird, well, there's not much left from of that bird. So what you have, you can sample the blood of the bird or get the DNA sequences to figure out what kind of bird caused the bird strike in the aircraft engine.
Excuse me, можно? May I interrupt for a short time?
Sure, sure. Okay.
Вот здесь было рассказано о задачах филогении. Я думаю, биологи все хорошо понимают, для что она сама по себе не только интересна, чтобы восстановить историю, там, как организмы дивергировали, но также в таких интересных задачах, как классификация бактериальных сообществ, которые получены, например, из воздушных фильтров, посмотреть, что за бактерии там обитают. Затем вот бактериальные сообщества на студенческом доклад сессии был про матрасы бактериальные. Вот что за бактерии там наблюдают, как их можно классифицировать, к какому типу отнести. Ну и вот пример, когда птицы попадают в самолет, да, никогда нету непонятно, что за птицы, только можно по крови определить. По остаткам крови. И вот используют методы, когда по остаткам крови можно секвенировать последовательности организма и отнести их к тому или иному классу. То есть это, в общем-то, довольно не только такой философский термин, да, а еще очень даже практический филогения. Окей.
Зачем нужно определять птиц?
Некоторые чаще попадают, некоторые реже, видимо, я так понимаю. То есть они попадают в самолет, и самолет разбивается от этого. Против каких птиц надо отстреливать, грубо говоря. Да. Окей. Да, на какой высоте там они попадают. То есть это, в общем-то, понятно, что воробьи на километровой высоте не будут встречаться. Окей. Окей. That's about details of aircraft crash.
Okay. Any questions so far? Okay. So, now, if we look at this problem of just phylogenetic classification, trying to find out where those unidentified query taxa fit into the reference tree, so the basic question we ask is, well, you know, where do they fit into this tree? But So one problem we have now, one problem we're working on right now is, can we really compute an assignment of those query sequences to certain regions of the reference tree with some measure of support? So that's some kind of current research topic. Another problem is with the input data. So as I said previously, we have this reference alignment for the reference tree, for which we assume that we have the correct topology or that it's a widely accepted topology. And then we have those query sequences here. So typically now with the new wet lab techniques, you have relatively short reads from those new power sequencing techniques of 454 reads, which have a length of approximately 250 base pairs. And one important question we have now, both computationally, because we might have 100,000 to 500,000 reads of 250 base pairs each, and one important question here is, how do we really align those query sequences to the reference alignment? So those are just some open issues the community is currently facing. All right, so another nice application for phylogenetic trees, this is the spread of the avian influenza virus from 1996 to 2004. So you can visualize those phylogenetic trees very nicely combined with some biogeographical data on Google Earth. And essentially the different colors on the tree show you the different host animals. Okay, so just a quick summary of some challenges for phyloinformatics. So that's how the area calls itself now. So one important thing is that we want this, we have this one holy grail in bioinformatics. We want to compute the tree of life that contains all living species on Earth. But I think that we're still 10 to 20 years away from that. Another very important problem we have is that the amount of available sequence data is growing at a much higher rate than our algorithms and computer architectures are getting faster. So we're just constantly trying to catch up with the developments in the wet lab techniques. Another thing, or another current trend, is that we have people have started to analyze large multi-gene phylogenies. So essentially what they do is that they concatenate many, many genes for the organisms they're interested in and get very long alignments, which they somehow have to fit into memory. Another hot issue now, if we look more at the developments in computer architecture, is that we need to port our codes for phylogenetic inference to multi-core architectures. And finally, a question that I already mentioned is, what is really a good multiple sequence alignment in a phylogenetic context? Actually, there was just a paper that came out, I think, last week about phylogeny where multiple sequence alignment, either in Nature or Science. So if you're interested in multiple alignment methods, that would be a nice thing, nice paper to have a look at. And finally, another open question is, how do we assess confidence for our results? So how do we assess our confidence that the tree we have inferred is correct or somehow corresponds to reality or to the history we are trying to infer? Okay, so basically this is the outline of the tree of life. So once again, what we're assuming is that we have a common joint ancestor of all living species. Then we have those inner nodes, so those extinct common ancestors in the branches, and the currently living species are located here at the tips of the tree. So this is the major goal bioinformatics has, or our area has, for the next 10 or 20 years. Okay. Now the first thing we're going to do is to look at the algorithmic problem we face when we try to reconstruct phylogenetic trees. So the problem is that all models or methods for phylogenetic inference provide us with some means or some kind of function that allows us to assign a score to certain topologies. So essentially we have to search among topologies to find the best scoring tree under our optimality criterion. And now the problem is that we have this large number of trees. So for three sequences, well, we just have one single unrooted binary tree, so those three sequences would be located at the tips here. And now, so this is a tree of size 3. Now we can start building larger trees by just inserting an additional taxon to all branches of the tree of the smaller size. So tree of size number n is built by inserting a new branch into all branches of tree of size n minus 3. So what happens here, for example, is that we have, so we add a new taxon to our tree. This is this yellow branch here. And we just insert it into all branches of the previous tree. And as you can see here, for four taxa, four organisms, four sequences, we already have three alternative tree topologies, which we must score in order to find the best one under our optimality criteria. So we can continue doing that. So if we look at all trees of size 5, we insert a new taxon, once again outlined in yellow here, into all branches of all trees of the smaller size. And so for five taxa, we already have 15 alternative tree topologies. We can continue doing that. So for 6 taxa, we have 105 alternative tree topologies. And so if we go on just adding taxa and adding taxa, what happens is that the number of trees just explodes exponentially. And this is the main algorithmic problem we are facing in phylogenetic tree reconstruction. So this is just a table with some figures here, which outlines the algorithmic problem. So the number of potential alternative trees grows exponentially. So for 5 taxa, we have 15 alternative distinct tree topologies. For 10, we have 2 million. For 15, we have 7 to the power of 12 or something. And for 50, we have 10 to the power of 76. So this is a huge search space in which we have to find the best scoring tree according to our optimality criterion, according to the scoring function. So just as an example, this number here, just for 50 taxa, which nowadays would be considered to be a small phylogenetic tree, the number of tree topologies you can get for 50 taxa corresponds approximately to the number of atoms in the universe. So that gives you an idea of how large this number really is. Yeah.
Идея заключается в следующем, что, как правило, когда строят филогеническое дерево, обычно делают следующее. То есть каждой топологии дерева присваивается некое число. Например, вот методы парсимонии, там это некий вес дерева, да. Допустим, максимальное правдоподобие – это некое соответствие топологии дерева и наблюдаемым данным. И алгоритмически задача заключается в следующем. Из всех возможных топологий нужно выбрать такую топологию дерева, которая имеет максимальное значение этого числа. То есть это задача некой комбинаторной оптимизации. Проблема заключается в том, что с ростом числа особей, для которых нужно построить дерево, число возможных топологий деревьев растет экспоненциально, и вот даже для 50 оно просто-напросто невообразимо огромно, сравнимо с числом атомов во всей Вселенной. Вот надо из этого объема данных выбрать одно дерево, самое лучшее. Окей.
Thanks. Question so far?
Why you show only unrooted tree? What about rooted tree?
Well, the optimality functions are defined on unrooted trees, actually. So rooting the trees is a different problem. So maximum likelihood, the function works on unrooted trees. That's why I deal with. So that's the kind of search space we're looking at when we're doing maximum likelihood-based inference. So that's the main reason for looking at unrooted trees.
Okay.
More questions? Okay. All right. So now we'll just have a very abstract look at the maximum likelihood function itself. So the way more or less a computer scientist looks at it, so where does all the computational load come from when we compute the likelihood function? So as I already said, we have some kind of multiple sequence alignment as an input. So just 4 sequences here, and this has a length of m, so essentially the alignment length, the number of base pairs in the multiple sequence alignment. So that's the first thing we need. Then we need some kind of nucleotide or amino acid substitution model that provides the instantaneous transition rates from A to A, A to C, A to G, and A to T. So that's a substitution model. That's something we can explicitly define or even estimate under the likelihood model. So this is the second thing we need to input into that program. As a third part of the input data, we need the prior probabilities or empirical base frequencies. So usually what happens is that you just draw those empirical base frequencies from the multiple sequence alignment. So essentially you just count how many A, C, and Gs and Ts occur in the multiple sequence alignment. Or you can, alternatively, you can also do a maximum likelihood estimate of those empirical base frequencies. So that's all for the statistics. And then, so now we're not looking at the search problem, so we don't look at the tree space. We're just trying to understand what we have to do in order to compute the likelihood score for one given fixed tree topology. So we have this fixed tree topology here. We have the sequences, the sequence data located at the tips, and we have some branch lengths as well. So we have 5 branches and those 4 sequences located at the tips. And now, the first thing we have to do in order to be able to compute the likelihood efficiently for such a tree is that we have to place a virtual root. So this is still an unrooted tree, but for the computation, we have to place a virtual root into the tree in order to compute the likelihood function. So one very important issue here is that under certain restrictions to the substitution, to this nucleotide substitution model, regardless of where we place that virtual root in the tree, so regardless if we place it, whether we place it here, 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 or here, we will always get the same likelihood score. And essentially, this happens if the nucleotide substitution model is time reversible, which means that evolution, the evolutionary process, happened or occurred in the same way if we follow it forward or backwards in time. In practice, this means that essentially we need some kind of symmetry in this matrix here, so in this nucleotide substitution matrix. If this is given, so if time reversibility of the model is given, then we can just place our virtual root in any part of the tree, in any branch of the tree, and we'll always get the same likelihood score, which of course has major computational advantages. Because, so if we didn't have a time reversible model, actually to compute the likelihood score of that tree, we would have to assess or to compute different placements of the root in this tree. All right. So once we have placed the virtual root into our tree, so let's say just into branch 5, what we do in order to compute the likelihood score is, or the main operation we do, is that we compute those conditional likelihood arrays here at the inner nodes. So essentially, for every column of the alignment, so they have a length m, for every column of the alignment, we compute something like a probability profile for the inner sequence at this position. So we compute the probability for every column in this alignment here of observing an A, a C, a G, or a T at this specific position. And we do the same thing for all other internal nodes of the tree, and do this for every column of the alignment. So this is the first step, and actually this is where all the floating point operations we have to conduct come from, and also where the memory footprint of the large memory footprint of phylogenetic analyses under maximum likelihood comes from. So this is the most important part, computational. So once we have computed those values for the inner likelihood vectors or conditional likelihood arrays, whatever you might call them, in order just to get the maximum likelihood score for that one fixed, so for this one specific tree topology, we also have to optimize the branch lengths just to get the likelihood score for one single tree topology. And finally, we also have to optimize the model parameters. So this, what I'm showing here, is actually a simple model, so you might add more model parameters to make the model more realistic and so on and so forth. But we also have to optimize the model parameters. And only when we have done that do we really have the maximum likelihood score for that one single specific tree topology. Okay. So just a summary, what we have, so the goal, evidently, is just to obtain or to search for the tree topology that yields the maximum likelihood value. So the problem number one is that the number of possible topologies is exponential in n, so we cannot really solve this in an optimal way. We will just have to devise some heuristics, and we'll be able to return some best-known tree, but not the maximum likelihood tree with respect to the search space. The second problem is that the computation of the likelihood function itself is very expensive. The third problem is that probably our heuristics need to yield a high score accuracy. So if you consider classic optimization problems like the traveling salesman problem, you would say that heuristics that get you within 5 or 10% of the optimal solution are good heuristics. Whereas in this case, some experiments have shown that we need to get within less than 1% of the optimal solution to obtain biologically reasonable trees. And, well, finally, problem number 4 is the high memory consumption, especially if you think about the accumulation of sequence data, growing alignment sizes, and so on and so forth. So some solutions to that are to devise new search algorithms that traverse, that search this huge search space of alternative tree topologies in a more efficient, more intelligent manner, we can devise new models or model approximations in order to somehow pre-score our tree topologies and make the scoring of the alternatives somehow faster. And finally, we can apply high-performance computing techniques to handle the large computational requirements of those methods. So what I'll do in the rest of the talk is to just present some solutions by example of RaxML. So this is the open source code I have developed for file genetic inference, and also make some general comments about how search algorithms work in general. Okay, so just one more point, and I'll be done with the introduction. So just some usage statistics. So since August 2006, we've had around 3,000 downloads, most of them from the United States, because typically scientists in the United States work with the largest data sets. And a thing that might be interesting for you if you just need to do file genetic analyses in practice is that we have set up two web servers using a new bootstrapping algorithm. So one's located at the San Diego Supercomputing Center and one at the Vital IT unit in Switzerland. So those are just freely available for people to do file genetic analyses online without having to install the program and so on and so forth. And those are pretty heavily used, so we have over 11,000 jobs since fall last year.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Why there is only 60% against?
Pardon me?
Can you go back and just calculate the percents and you will see it's only 60 in total?
No. There are 58 other countries, and each of them is below 5%.
Okay.
Any more questions on the maths?
Maybe start short comments.
Okay.
Идея заключается в следующем, что вот для топологии дерева вычисляется некая функция, которая зависит от вероятности замен аминонуклеотидов. Эта вот матрица была показана. Зависит от частот встречаемости нуклеотидов. Их можно оценить как методом максимального подоподобия, так и эмпирически, просто посчитав, сколько нуклеотидов каждого типа в выравнивании находится. И, собственно говоря, идея заключается в следующем, что можно оптимизировать не только в общем виде, можно оптимизировать не только длинный ветвей дерева. Вот что было показано такими кружочками, что обычно при заданной топологии можно также оптимизировать длинный ветвей дерева. И второе, можно оптимизировать параметры эволюции. То есть если вы интересуетесь не топологией дерева, а интересуетесь, какие замены у вас происходят, или там, допустим, какие частоты нуклеотидов вы хотите оценить, вы можете использовать функцию правдоподобия и для получения оценки параметров. Функция правдоподобия, likelihood function, это некое соответствие вашей модели численной наблюдаемым данным. То есть в параметрах этой модели это вот частоты нуклеотидов, фенологическое дерево, матрица замен. Все вы можете оптимизировать. Это вот некий такой универсальный, очень удобный способ известной статистики. Окей.
Questions? Yes, that's exactly the case. So if we don't have a time reversible model in order to get or to compute the likelihood score of the tree, we need to place a virtual root essentially in every branch of the tree to score that tree. I think there is a paper from 2006 or something like that where by some French guys where they propose a better way to efficiently compute the likelihood under non-time reversible models. But I just know that this paper exists, so I haven't really actually read it. But if you're interested, I could probably find the reference and give it to you. But essentially, so the argument for time reversibility, or the main argument, is just that it's easier to compute the likelihood score.
Okay, thank you.
All right. So, Now we're just going to have a look at the search algorithms by themselves, so just understand how the typical implementations that are used nowadays work. So basically what they do, what most current search algorithms do, is that they initially compute a comprehensive starting tree. So comprehensive starting tree means that they compute some starting tree that already contains all sequences, all tags of the alignment. And this is usually done by just using one of the simpler methods. So they might compute a starting tree using neighbor joining or maximum parsimony, or even just use a complete random starting tree. So for example, complete random starting trees are used by Mr. Bayes for Bayesian phylogenetic inference, and Gourley, which is a maximum likelihood implementation that uses a genetic search algorithm. Neighbor joining is used by IQPNNI and PhiML. And finally, RaxML uses maximum parsimony. And so once we have this this starting tree, what we do then is that we just try to increase or improve the likelihood of the starting tree by just applying some kind of standard pattern of topological alteration. So we just change something in the tree topology and then reevaluate the likelihood and see if the tree improves. So there are various techniques for altering, for changing the tree topology. We have nearest neighbor interchange, tree bisection reconnection, and subtree pruning and regrafting, which is also called subtree rearrangement. So we'll see those techniques in a little bit more detail on the next slides. So this is a kind of basic mechanism in order to change the topology and hopefully improve it. And then you can kind of use those basic operations on trees in order to design your search algorithm. So there are various strategies you can apply, for example, for avoiding local optima. So the most simple one is just hill climbing. So I just try to apply some changes to the tree until I cannot further improve the likelihood score of the tree. Another technique that allows some kind of backward steps, and hopefully you will be able to avoid some local optima, is simulated annealing. You can apply genetic search algorithms. And finally, Metropolis-coupled Markov chain Monte Carlo methods to somehow accommodate backward steps. If you get stuck in one local optimum, move out of it again and hopefully go uphill further. So now let's just look at the three basic techniques to change tree topology. So one basic technique, the most simple move, is a nearest neighbor interchange. So, well, let's assume that we have just given a tree here with those four differently colored subtrees located here. What we do is that we just, well, first of all, we might just exchange those two subtrees here, so the red one and the yellow one. Then once we have exchanged those subtrees, we reevaluate the likelihood of the tree and look if it has improved. And then we do the other operation, so the other change we can do at this level, just interchanging nearest neighbors. We'll interchange the blue and the yellow tree, and once again reevaluate the likelihood and see if the score of the tree improves. So this is the nearest neighbor interchange technique. Now subtree pruning regrafting is a little bit more complicated. So we'll just select one subtree in our current maximum likelihood tree, so the red one here, and then just prune it, so just remove it from the tree at a first step, and then just start reinserting this subtree initially at a distance of one node, so one node away from the original pruning position. So we do that for all insertion positions that have a distance of one node away from the original pruning position. So we can just do that. We reevaluate the likelihood, and so on and so forth. And then we can continue. So we can actually, this is a little bit more elaborate technique because we can specify some kind of radius where we search around the current tree topology. So we can also do it at a distance of two nodes away from the original pruning position. So one, two nodes away. Check all insertions there, and so on and so forth. And so what we have to do, what is important here in the standard application of that subtree pruning regrafting technique, is that once we have reinserted this subtree here, we actually need to optimize, to re-optimize all branches of the tree topology in order to get the maximum likelihood score of that new altered tree topology. Okay, and finally, tree bisection reconnection. What you do here is, well, you have two subtrees, the one on the left and the one on the right, which are connected by one branch. And essentially what you do is that you initially just remove that branch and then connect the two subtrees, so the bisected tree essentially. You insert a new branch between all pairwise combinations of branches on the right-hand side and on the left-hand side. So you would just do all those kind of operations here. Okay. So now let's have a little bit closer look how RaxML works. So now this was, yeah.
Здесь были показаны техники, как изменяется топология дерева, как ее перебирать. Поскольку это очень важно, надо как можно в идеале перебрать побольше комбинаций, чтобы получить в итоге более-менее равномерное покрытие, что ли. То есть вот несколько способов были приведены, это как перестраивать топологию дерева. Окей.
Окей. Any questions? Okay. All right, so now these were the general techniques just for changing the tree topologies. Now we're going to look into a little bit more detail how this is implemented in RaxML and how this was optimized in RaxML. So initially, as I already mentioned, RaxML uses a maximum parsimony starting tree, but what it does is that it uses a randomized stepwise addition order maximum parsimony tree. So we just see what that is in the next slide. So initially, we might just have our input sequences here, so say five sequences, and we'll start stepwise, we'll start building a tree, a comprehensive tree, in a stepwise manner. So initially, we might just randomly select three sequences out of those five sequences from our input alignment and place them in the just one possible, or assign them to the one possible tree topology we have for three sequences. In the next step, we then randomly pick one of the remaining sequences, so say sequence number two, and just insert it into all branches of the current tree, and compute the maximum, in this case, the maximum parsimony score for all those possible insertions of sequence number two, and just keep the tree, so finally insert sequence number two at the position for which we get the best maximum parsimony score. And so this is a tree, so we have done our stepwise addition operation and have inserted sequence number two, and then we just have one sequence remaining. We do the same thing, so we ask, well, what are the scores for inserting sequence zero into all branches of the current tree? And we just insert it once again at the point where we have the best maximum parsimony score. So, and this is our starting tree. Now, the thing here is that if we change the addition order, so as I said, we just randomly select sequences from our input data and add them to the tree. So a distinct addition order, for example here, so if we had added sequence 0, 1, 2, then 3, and then 4, this can actually yield a different starting tree. And this is a property we actually want because, so this is something I see as an advantage of RaxML, because the search, if you execute the program several times, like 10 or 20 times, the search for the maximum likelihood tree, because we have a different starting tree, starts at different points in this very large search space. So the probability of obtaining a better solution in a certain way is higher because we have those different starting points and might avoid local optima. So once we have the starting tree, then we apply a lazy subtree rearrangement mechanism. So we'll see that in more detail on the next slide. And an interesting thing now is that, well, you know, there has been a lot of work on search algorithms over the last 4 to 5 years, and most current maximum likelihood implementations nowadays use some kind of lazy SPR move. Okay. And then, so RaxML is very, very simple, just hill climbing. We just apply those rearrangements to the tree until we cannot find a tree that has a better likelihood value that cannot be further improved by applying those moves. So now if we go back to the subtree rearrangements, we encountered this problem here that once we have done this subtree pruning regrafting approach, essentially if we change the tree, we need to re-optimize all branches. Now the lazy subtree rearrangements, how they work is that we don't re-optimize all branches, but what we do is that we just reoptimize. So once we have pruned the tree from its the subtree from its original position and inserted it into one branch here, we just optimize the three branches, 1, 2, 3, eject them to the insertion position, which of course does not yield us the maximum likelihood score for this new topology, but some kind of approximate likelihood score for this changed topology, which gives us some idea of how much the likelihood score might improve if we alter the topology in this way. So, well, why does this work? First of all, those subtree rearrangements mean that we have to update a significantly lower number of conditional likelihood arrays, so that it's significantly faster. At the same time, it allows for a higher rearrangement setting. So once we have pruned the tree from the original position, we can insert it at a distance of more nodes away from the original pruning position, so we can look at a broader, a greater number of trees, so we will receive better trees in the end. Important thing is that the likelihood depends strongly on the topology, and essentially what this allows us to do is that we can rapidly pre-score a large number of alternative topologies. So we will get an approximate likelihood score for a very large number of alternative topologies. We can then sort those alternative topologies by their approximate likelihood score, and then just have a closer look, so do a full optimization of branch lengths, compute the real maximum likelihood score just for the 20 or 30 or so best pre-scored trees. Okay, and so, well, how do you justify that? So the algorithmic development in our domain in file informatics is very experimental, very empirical. So experimental results just justify this mechanism or show that this mechanism works and yields better scoring likelihood trees. Okay, so now if we look a little bit further, what we can also do is some kind of likelihood cutoff procedure in order to make the algorithms work much faster. So you might consider what happens with the approximate likelihood score if I insert the subtree number 6 into this branch here. And then, so if the likelihood at this point here, or the approximate likelihood value at this point here, is smaller than a dynamically determined threshold value, so essentially this provides me a notion. If I move with this subtree towards this part of the tree down here, this might not be a good region to put the subtree into, right? Because the approximate likelihood score gets very bad compared to other directions into which I can move the tree. So essentially what I say, if the likelihood is smaller than a specific threshold, I can just cut off the descent or stop the descent into the subsequent subtrees, into the subsequent branches in this part of the tree, because I figured out at the previous point that moving the subtree into this direction of the tree is not very promising. So those lazy subtree rearrangements are actually not executed. And this yields an additional speed up of around factor 2 or 2.5. Okay, so final thing that is important is the rearrangement setting, so just the radius, the maximum distance at which you reinsert your subtrees, and this is very alignment dependent. So this setting has a significant impact on performance, and we have some very simple procedure to to automatically determine this radius or adapt this radius to the specific data set. Okay. So now this is the basic outline how generally search algorithms work and how they work in particular in RaxML. And now we have to look at another problem, which is a more kind of practical problem if you're doing a real phylogenetic analysis. So, and those are confidence values. So essentially, main thing is that if you're a biologist, you want to publish a phylogeny, a tree without node confidence values, so some measure of support for the individual subtrees, is mostly useless. So useless in this case means that you cannot publish it in a good journal. And the problem is that the confidence value calculation is actually the major computational obstacle in a real analysis now, which means that, well, we have those fast programs which, in fact, allow us to compute very large trees, so one single large tree or 10 large trees for one very big data set. But our ability to just compute a tree for a large data set does not mean that we can really analyze it. And Okay, there's some text missing here. But anyway, so just to show you a tree with confidence values, so this is for different languages or something. So what you want is to put some confidence values on the inner nodes or on the branches of the tree. So in how sure are you that this part of the tree, so those sequences here, those taxa here, actually group together in your experiments? So Kernslow methods to do that are either sampling with Bayesian methods, so MCMC sampling, or non-parametric bootstrapping, which is used in the maximum likelihood context. So those are just the standard approaches. So the way that works is that you have your original alignment, just the original sequence alignment, which then is perturbed. So essentially what you do is that you have your original alignment, and in order to produce a bootstrapped alignment, you just randomly draw columns from the original alignment until you have generated a bootstrapped alignment that has the same number of columns, so the same length, essentially, as the original alignment. But since this is a random process, you might have a different column composition in the bootstrapped alignments. So the thing here is that essentially what you're doing once you have those bootstrapped alignments is that you then apply your phylogenetic inference method once again on the bootstrapped alignments and compute the trees, which you then in turn use to assign confidence values to your reference tree. So what this method does is to look at how stable the tree topology is under slight alterations or slight perturbations of the input data. And so, well, one thing here is, so that's our computational problem if you really look at large trees, that this needs to be done, so there's a bootstrapping procedure, this needs to be done 100 to 1,000 times. The good news is, so now this is the first connection to what Thomas was telling you earlier, this is an embarrassingly parallel problem, right? So the inferences, the individual bootstrap analyses are completely independent from each other, so I can just generate the bootstrap replicates, distribute them to some kind of workstation cluster, and then infer them, and at the end just collect the results. Another important issue is that, well, how many bootstraps, how many replicates do we really have to do? Because this is also a little bit alignment dependent. Some alignments may have a very strong signal, so it might be sufficient to do 100 bootstraps. Some other alignments, if you think about ITS data or something like that, just for a single gene, many sequences, might not have a very strong signal. So some of our current research is actually focusing on trying to develop or devise some kind of bootstrapping criterion that would give you some kind of, mechanism that tells you if you have done enough bootstrap replicates to achieve some kind of stable answer or stable support for the subtree.
Okay, sorry, may I interrupt?
Yeah, I think it's a good point.
Идея заключается в следующем, что даже если вы имеете дерево, вам нужно, для биолога очень важно знать, насколько вы можете доверять вот узлу в этом дереве. И для этого существует одна из наиболее часто употребляемых техник, которая называется bootstrapping. Это вы из вашего исходного выравнивания случайно дергаете колонки выравнивания и формируете новое выравнивание. На его основе строите снова филогеническое дерево, и в этих моделированных, симулированных деревьях, смотрите, насколько часто у вас вот такое ветвление вот в этом узле встречается. Подсчитываете, делаете это сотню раз, и если у вас в сотне экспериментов таких встретилось вот такое ветвление, то вы говорите, что у вас уровень доверия этому узлу высокий, 100%. Вот. Обычно это делается, сотни, может быть, иногда быть недостаточно, вот от сотни до тысячи экспериментов таких нужно делать. Задача парализуется совершенно просто, то есть это каждый процесс вычисления такого симуляции, он является независимым от других, то есть его очень легко можно распараллелить. Но требует времени очень большого, то есть фактически нужно 100 раз вычислить одно и то же дерево, пересчитать его. Окей.
Question so far? Okay. Shall we actually make a break or not?
Maybe сделаем перерыв или дальше пойдем? Дальше. Okay.
Yes or no?
Перерыв или без перерыва? Дальше. Okay. Without break.
Can I ask about this picture? At the first and second cases, two colors are doubled.
Yes.
But in the third case, only one of them.
Yeah.
Why it's so?
Well, that's just an example. I mean, that can happen.
So it shouldn't be so, yeah?
It can be so. It can be tripled or even...
In the same experiment, it can be done by different ways?
Yeah.
Yeah, you just... So you just sample...
Pick up the column and without regarding the order. You can pick up it twice. But if you have large alignment, it's reasonably that occurrence will be not so different from the initial one.
You just take the original alignment, just randomly draw columns from the different positions. So that's the procedure. Okay. So now, just once again, looking at the computational problem that arises within the framework of this bootstrapping, is that we said, well, okay, we need to do something. We need to devise a faster algorithm to allow people to do bootstrap analyses on large data sets. So, and the approach we've chosen here, because this is kind of a very empirical way to design heuristic algorithms, is that we did algorithmic engineering. So we made some changes in the search algorithm, we changed the heuristics, and then just ran a large number of computational experiments on a cluster on a broad variety of test data sets to see how this algorithm compares, so this new fast algorithm compares to the standard algorithm. So what we did is that we tested this algorithm during development on 22 very diverse real-world DNA and protein data sets, so both just single-gene alignments as well as multi-gene alignments, and also wide range of sequences, so 125 up to almost 8,000 sequences. So in order to assess the accuracy of this rapid algorithm that evidently uses some kind of approximations, we computed the Pearson correlation of the bootstrap support values induced by the standard method, so the slow algorithm, and the bootstrap values induced by the fast search algorithm, so the new algorithm, just on the best scoring tree. So we just mapped the bipartitions induced by the two sets of bootstrap replicates on the best scoring tree and computed the Pearson correlation for that. So in general, support values correlated, so the Pearson correlation was between 0.905 and 0.909, except on one data set at 0.901, and the average was 0.907. So this was one measure of accuracy to compare the bootstrap support values between two different algorithms. Another thing we did was to compute the weighted topological distance between the consensus trees computed from the slow bootstrap replicates and the fast bootstrap replicates. So essentially, this the RF distance is just a measure of topological distance between two tree topologies, and the weighted distance also accounts for the support of the individual tree. So if I have like two consensus trees and just one poorly supported clade in the consensus trees that has a different placement, so it has a support of 10%, I will penalize a misplacement of this one branch to a smaller extent. Because I say, well, if it has only a support of 10%, I'm not sure about the placement. So if only this branch is placed at different branches in the two trees, this just means that we're observing this instability of that specific subgroup. So the major point here is that we achieved a program acceleration of, well, factor 8 to 20, average around 15. So this is one order of magnitude. And the bottom line is that you can do a full maximum likelihood analysis, so publishable analysis, of data sets, so of single gene data sets up to 5,000 sequences within less than 5 days just on a single reasonably fast desktop. And another thing here is that this also allows you to conduct a sufficiently large number of bootstrap replicates, because typically 100 bootstrap replicates are not enough. Okay. So, So this is just one example of how we assess performance. Those are the support values induced by the rapid bootstrap trees on the best scoring tree, and those are the support values induced by the standard search method on the best scoring tree, a relatively large alignment, so 3,500 RBCL sequences.
Okay,
yeah.
Здесь был приведен пример, что Bootstrap – это очень трудоемкая задача, поэтому хочется его вычислить побыстрее. Вот был применен алгоритм быстрого Bootstrap, да. Конечно, он дает не точное совпадение результатов, но выигрывает очень сильно по быстроте, в 10 раз. И, в принципе, такой метод дает достаточно хорошую корреляцию 0,95-99% с данными точного метода. Вот по большому числу данных это было оценено. И, в принципе, хотя он, его значение Bootstrap отличается немного от того, что было делать стандартным Bootstrap, но, тем не менее, в некоторых случаях, когда особенно много последовательностей, можно пренебречь точностью небольшим, где-то 5%, вот, но зато выиграть в скорости. Иногда это бывает очень важно. Есть вопросы? Окей. Please. It was not just it was not explained. Okay, continue. It's about this slide, but you didn't talk
about
it.
Yeah, no, yet. Talked about that yet. Questions? Okay. So, no, actually, it doesn't decrease. It's just a log scale. Perhaps that was your question. So, this just to show the inference times or the computation times for the bootstrapping algorithms in various programs. So the y-axis here is just the log scale of the execution time in seconds, and the x-axis here corresponds to the number of sequences in the input data sets. So what you can see here, so this is the green line here, the standard RAC-SIML bootstrapping algorithm, and the red line here is the new rapid bootstrapping algorithm. So this is one order of magnitude. This is a Garlic program which yields qualitatively comparable trees, use a genetic search algorithm, but is more than two orders of magnitude slower than the rapid RAC-SIML bootstrapping algorithm. And finally here, we have FIML, which is another very widely used program, which, however, has a less powerful search algorithm, which means that it's equally fast as a standard RAC-SIML version, but yields trees of lower quality. And also, one of the problems of FIML is that it has much higher memory footprint, high degree of memory consumption than both Garlic and RAC-SIML, which just led it to crash for datasets larger, containing more than 2,500 sequences. So, okay, and just a slide to show you that how much people actually needed this rapid bootstrapping method, something to accelerate their analyses. So, those are just some usage statistics from the web server, the RAC-SIML web server at the San Diego Supercomputing Center. So x-axis are just the days of operation, and y-axis is just the number of jobs submitted per program. So you can see here this Cluster W, Garlic, RAC-SIML, so the standard RAC-SIML algorithm just for doing tree searches, Mr. Bayes, Pulp, also a very famous program, and this black line here is the rapid RAC-SIML bootstrapping. So you can see just by the usage that this was really something people needed to conduct the very large file genetic analyses. Okay, so since we're slowly running out of time, I'll just skip all the optimization stuff here and just tell you something about some modeling issues. So once again, one very important effect you have to account for as a biologist if you do phylogenetic analyses is that you have to accommodate rate heterogeneity among sites. So essentially, the fact that different columns of the alignment, as indicated by those colored arrows here, evolve at different speeds. So this phenomenon of rate heterogeneity has to be accounted for in your evolutionary models. So the gold standard for doing this is actually the gamma model of rate heterogeneity among sites. And the problem is that this is very, this is much more compute intensive and memory intensive, we'll see more details on the next slides, than the standard approach that does not account for rate heterogeneity. So what I've been working on was an efficient approximation for this gamma model of rate heterogeneity that improves execution times by factor 4, reduces memory footprint by factor 4, and more importantly, returns equally good tree as trees as a standard method. So what you do is that you conduct the tree search, so all the operations you need to score the trees and to search for the trees under this approximation, and just in the end, when you receive the final tree, you score it, you compute its score under the standard model, and compare it to the results of the inference that has been conducted the whole way under the standard gamma model, which is more compute intensive. So, let's have a look at the gamma distribution and see a little bit how that works. So, essentially, the gamma distribution is determined by this alpha parameter. So, in our maximum likelihood model, what we do is that we just try to optimize this, the likelihood score. So, for a fixed tree topology, we just try to optimize the likelihood score with respect to the alpha parameter. And this alpha parameter, what it means is if we have a small alpha like 0.5 or 1.0, is if we have a small value for alpha, we have a high rate, a high degree of rate heterogeneity, and if we estimate a large alpha parameter, we have a low rate, low degree of rate heterogeneity. And so what we have to do, we cannot really integrate over the whole function. What we have to do is to discretize the gamma distribution and draw discrete rates. So the typical approximation or implementation in current codes is that we use four discrete rates to approximate the gamma distribution.
Когда вы оцениваете фенологическое дерево, у вас очевидно, что не все позиции выравнивания одинаково эволюционируют. Есть позиции, которые эволюционируют быстрее, есть позиции, которые медленнее эволюционируют. Как это учесть? Если вы будете оценивать параметры эволюции для каждой модели, то у вас просто-напросто не хватит данных, то есть будет очень много параметров. Поэтому выход придумали такой. Считается, что скорости мутаций в выравнивании распределены вот по гамма-распределению, которое определяется только одним параметром альфа. Чем он меньше, тем это распределение шире. И вот что часть позиций имеет скорость, допустим, вот 0,5 и так далее. И если мы частоты вот этих вот скоростей в выравнивании нарисуем, то они у нас будут примерно как гамма-распределение, вот иметь форму гамма-распределения. И здесь пример такой, что это все контролируется одним параметром, да, высокая скорость, если очень разные скорости замен в выравнивании, то это маленький параметр альфа. Если все позиции эволюционируют примерно с одной скоростью, то это большое значение параметра альфа. То есть вы фактически, чтобы эти классы определить, вот дискретизируют его, разбивая нас на несколько столбиков, грубо говоря. И считается, что вот в позиции определенная доля позиций в выравнивании с заданной скоростью замен, которая определяется величиной вот альфа-распределения, гамма-распределения. Окей. Понятно? Или нет? Более-менее так. Окей.
Окей. Any questions so far? Окей. So, now what we have, what the major issue is with the gamma-based models of rate heterogeneity is that, so if we have those four discrete rates or even more discrete rates from the gamma distribution, what we essentially do or need to do computationally is that we have to compute the likelihood score for on the tree for every single one of those four discrete rates. So we have to compute in a certain way for every column, we have to compute four likelihood scores for every individual discrete rate. And that's where the longer inference times come from, and also the higher memory consumption. Because instead of just scoring one conditional kind of likelihood array for each column of the alignment, so just the probability of observing A, C, G, and T at each inner node for a specific column, we have to do this four times, so we have to store it four times for every discrete rate of the model. And so this is what I've outlined here in a very, well, abstract way. So for the gamma loop, if we just compute the partial likelihood error entry, so this is not real code, just a very top-down view, we have to compute those entries of the likelihood array, so the probabilities of observing A, C, and G, and T, four times for each discrete gamma ray. So what I proposed, or what the approximation is that just for every individual column of the alignment, we try to estimate an individual rate just for one column, and then make a categorization of those individual rates into a smaller number of rate categories, and such that we just have to compute this function, essentially f, which does my conditional likelihood array computations. The details don't really matter, so we just compute it one time. And this is a basic idea which both saves us, as you can see here, so we just invoke this f function where we hide all the floating point operations. We just compute it once, and we just store it once. That's where the efficiency from this approximation comes from. So just some examples. Execution time development, so the x-axis is the time in seconds. This is just the log likelihood score. The log likelihood score under the gamma model, so we scored the intermediate trees under the standard model. And as you can see here, this is the inference under the gamma model, so under the heavy standard model, and this is the inference under the approximation. So this yields substantial performance improvements and speed improvements. So that's the same kind of diagram for the approximation for a larger data set. Okay, so that's about it for the gamma model. So this really is just an example to show you that we need model approximations in order to be able to handle the constantly growing data sets. Okay, so I'd probably skip the next slides and go directly to the high-performance computing-related part. So now we change our view completely. We don't look at the computation of the likelihood method and model approximations and search algorithms. We just try to understand how we can really compute or how we can really parallelize phylogenetic inferences. So initially, we'll just have a look at the different levels or the different granularities of parallelism that are inherent to this specific problem. So the top level, which we've already seen within the framework of bootstrap analyses, is embarrassing parallelism. So just generate a whole bunch of bootstrap analyses of bootstrap replicates, distribute them to some kind of clusters or workstations or whatever. You can do the same thing for the actual maximum likelihood search. So just generate a bunch of starting trees and then compute a maximum likelihood tree for the individual starting trees on different CPUs. So this is what we call embarrassing parallelism because it's very easy to implement. It yields you a high degree of parallel efficiency and can, you know, it can be implemented with a number of technologies, MPI, CORBA, or some kind of grid technology or whatever. So this is very nice at a very coarse-grained level. It yields us a high level of efficiency. Okay, so that's a basic outline. You have a master process, some interconnection network, which does not really need to be fast, and you just have the worker processes that work on the individual bootstrap replicates. Okay, now the second level that is nested within this top level of embarrassing parallelism is inference parallelism. So with inference parallelism, I mean, so this the term of I have invented for this specific problem. With inference parallelism, I mean that we try to actually parallelize the steps of the search algorithm. So, you know, do some kind of subtree insertion simultaneously or something like that. So what I don't like about this type of parallelism is that this is very much algorithm dependent. Because some algorithms, some search algorithms, in the way they do their moves or in the way they traverse, they travel through search space, might have a large number of sequential dependencies and will therefore be hard to parallelize. So if I try to work at the inference parallelism level, this will just be a very specific solution for a very specific program. So this is nothing that is generally applicable, unlike the top level of embarrassing parallelism. So, there, for example, in RaxML, this is difficult because we have a lot of sequential dependencies. I will not go into the details. And so one main reason why I'm saying that this inference parallelism is not really worth looking at is that we, at an even more fine-grained level, we have loop-level parallelism. So we can actually parallelize the computations of the likelihood function itself. And now this loop-level parallelism can be exploited using various programming paradigms. So, for example, OpenMP, which you've seen a little bit with Thomas, you can use pthreads, so that's kind of basic, very low-level threads-based programming library. So you can schedule that or exploit this type of parallelism on graphics processing units, on the IBM Cell processor, and hence the PlayStation, on the IBM BlueJean, which is a completely different architecture, but it works as well, and also on standard off-the-shelf clusters, which need a fast interconnect. So this type of loop-level parallelism applies or can be applied to all programs that mainly that spend most of their time just computing the likelihood function. So let's now have a look at the loop-level parallelism in a little bit more detail. So once we have placed our virtual root somewhere up in the tree, the thing or the operation we just spend most of our time in is the computation of those conditional likelihood arrays. So basically it's just three functions that do all the likelihood computations, and structurally they all look alike. So in this abstract layer we have this vector conditional likelihood array P here, which is just computed by combining the values of vector Q and vector R by some number of floating point operations and storing the results in vector P and then just moving up towards the virtual root. And one important point here, or one of the major assumptions of the maximum likelihood model, is that the columns of the alignment evolve independently. I mean, from a biological point of view, this might not be very realistic, but this is the assumption. And actually, it's a very nice assumption for us to exploit parallelism. So that's why we need the assumption of rate of independent evolution of columns, because essentially, so entries I and I plus 1 can be computed, as you can see by this simple formula here, completely independently from each other. So if I have, say, if the length of this vector is 100, I can, if I had 100 processors, I could compute those 100 entries independently from each other in parallel. So the important thing here is that in all current likelihood-based phylogenetic implementations, either Bayesian inference or maximum likelihood inference, it doesn't really matter, this type of operation uses more than 95% of total execution time. So what we can do, since this is those the computation of those entries between iterations I and I plus 1 are independent from each other, we can apply a simple fine-grained parallelization. So the way that works is, just if you remember what Thomas told you about OpenMP, essentially what we do is that we split up this the computations or those vectors, we just split them up in the middle, we generate two threads, or we fork two threads, one blue thread and one red thread, and then we just assign one part, so 50% of the computations to one thread and 50% of the computations to another thread. And ideally, of course, those threads will be running on different CPUs such that we can achieve a high degree of parallelism. So now if we look at this kind of loop-level parallelism a little bit more practical way, what we have here is just our input alignment and essentially the data structures associated to it. So those are just the alignment columns. And here we have a shared memory machine, so every CPU has the same access or sees the same memory space. And then we just have our CPUs here with their little cache memories attached to them. So essentially what this does, what the previous slide does, or what this approach does, is that we just assign slices of the alignment and of the data structures of equal size to each individual CPU. Okay, so we've been working quite a lot on high-performance computing methods or ways to orchestrate and exploit this type of parallelism, because this is something that is generally applicable not only to RaxML but to all programs, to a large variety of hardware architectures. And so what we're doing are two things. One thing is more on the computer science side of things, looking at like proof of concept parallelization, so just say, well, hey, it works, we can make it work on this specific architecture and programming techniques. So we looked at if this likelihood function can be ported to graphics processing units and to the IBM Cell and the PlayStation. So this is just proof of concept, which means that we've not ported the whole functionality of the program to a specific architecture, but we just show that, well, it can potentially be done. And then we have production-level parallelization. So this is just mapping the full functionality of the program with all different models and likelihood functions and essentially data types for both DNA and protein data. We try to map the whole functionality to a variety of architectures. So we've done that with OpenMP. with .NET with MPI at the coarse grained level, so just distributing bootstrap replicates. We have done that also with MPI at the very fine grained level on the IBM Lugene. And we've done that with pthreads, so we changed from OpenMP to pthreads, which is essentially more or less the same thing, if you look at it from a very abstract point of view. But we had specific reasons to change from OpenMP to pthreads, and looked how to port it and how to make it run efficiently on multi-core architectures. And these are also all production-level parallelizations, which means that we also have data sets from biologists, and we're working on big analysis with those guys. So now if we look in a little bit more detail on orchestrating the phylogenetic likelihood function on massively parallel machines. So actually, this is a distributed memory machine, and this is the problem we have with the IBM Lugene. We have a large number of processors, so 1,024 processors just in one single rack of that machine. And we have a relatively low amount of memory, so 512 megabyte or 1 gigabyte per node. But the good thing is that, well, the CPUs, so the individual processors, are relatively slow, but the interconnection network between the nodes or the individual processors is very fast. So we have a good ratio between processor speed and network speed. And so some of the challenges we had here really for porting this type of loop-level parallelism to the IBM Lugene was to somehow distribute the tree data structure among CPUs and efficiently exploit the fast collective communication network. And so the way this works is that we have kind of separation, once again, a very classic master worker scheme. So we just have a master process that orchestrates the likelihood function computations, and that is the only process among all the processes that participate in the computation of the likelihood score, is the only process that actually knows what the tree topology is, or handles the tree topology. So only the master process keeps this tree topology here and steers the tree search. And the only thing it does is that it issues some commands to the worker processes that, once again, have just one slice of the data structures and one slice, so in this simple example here, 50% of the input alignment. And so essentially what the master process tells the workers is to apply some kind of functions to their part of the data. And what we can do with the conditional likelihood arrays is just to enumerate them consistently in the master here and the workers here, such that the master has only got to issue commands to the worker processes, so combine me vectors 1, 2, and number 5 by some specific likelihood operation. So this is the basic outline, how this works, how we can orchestrate the computation of the likelihood function on a distributed memory architecture. So the basic idea is that the workers don't need to know at all what the current tree structure is, nor what the tree search is doing. Okay, so we're also looking at other current parallel architectures. So one thing I mentioned in the very beginning is that we have this continuous trend towards multi-gene analysis. And so we have those very long and memory-intensive data sets that can now already reach memory footprints of 16 gigabytes or something like that. Another problem we have with multi-core architectures is that processes and threads on the cores actually compete for memory access bandwidth. So this is the kind of memory gap problem we have. And what we try to figure out is which is the best parallel programming paradigm or language. So those are the paradigms Thomas showed you earlier for maximum likelihood. But now, so since we're looking at applications and since we're developing a real tool, we're looking at the typical engineering issues like efficiency, usability, portability, programming overhead, and program complexity. Another thing we asked is, well, which is the best multi-core architecture for maximum likelihood-based inference? By example of RaxML. So the basic idea here is, since we're more application developers and not just doing pure high-performance computing research, is that we want to integrate those concepts into one piece of code that can actually scale from just two cores biologist might have in his desktop computer up to 1,024 CPUs on the IBM Lugene. And this both on shared memory machines as well as on distributed memory machines. So we want to it to scale on a wide variety of CPU numbers and on a wide variety of different parallel computer architectures. So, okay, I think you've seen most of that in Thomas's talks. So let me just say some things about pthreads. So pthreads is a low-level shared memory programming library. Essentially, we do by hand everything that OpenMP does automatically, because with OpenMP, you just insert those pragmas, and essentially what it does is that it does the loop splitting, it integrates loop splitting automatically into the code, and then uses pthreads to actually do the computation. So OpenMP is some kind of translation into some, does some kind of translation to some intermediate form of code that is then based on, that then uses pthreads to actually do the computations. So, as I said, pthreads is low level. It induces, compared to OpenMP, this really induces a significant programming overhead, so we needed 4 weeks to do that. But in contrast to OpenMP, this provides us full control over the machine. Because with OpenMP, well, we insert those pragmas, but then we don't really know what the OpenMP compiler is actually doing. And while pthreads really provides us full control over the machine. And one other thing with pthreads is that you don't really need an OpenMP-enabled compiler, so you just need to have the library installed, which is default on current Mac and Linux systems. So actually, since this is easier to compile and install, now biologists have really started using it. Unlike with the OpenMP version, where they need an OpenMP-based compiler, it might get better with GCC, which offers OpenMP now since version 4.2. But this is a major issue if you really look at the fact that biologists are non-specialist users. Okay, so some problems with OpenMP. I won't go into the details really. So just one major point here for me personally is that OpenMP is a little bit like Windows. So you don't really know what it does, and you cannot really influence what is happening, which I personally don't like, especially if we're looking at computer architecture issues. But the nice thing, of course, is that it's very easy to parallelize code. So recently, we needed to parallelize Mr. Bayes, so this is the most famous and most cited program for Bayesian file genetic inference, and it just took us 5 hours with OpenMP to parallelize Mr. Bayes from scratch. So do the profiling, insert the OpenMP pragmas, and do the testing. So this is the nice thing about OpenMP. So one major problem with OpenMP is a kind of non-determinism in the reduction operations. So typically what we have in our application is, well, we have this fork join model, so we get into a parallel region, just a parallel for loop, to compute the entries of the conditional likelihood arrays. So we just, you know, start the individual threads to compute one part of the conditional likelihood array, and then just have to sum over the individual entries in some sense. So the way this works is that, well, the overall log likelihood score is just the sum of the individual log likelihood scores computed by each individual thread, so the individual fractions. And finally, so the reduction operation, what it does is just that it adds the per thread sums. And the bad thing here is that the order of these additions in the OpenMP standard is non-deterministic. So any permutation of this sum is possible. Unlike in MPI, where you have a very strict kind of tree-based reduction operation, which means that the order of the additions always takes place, always happens in the same order. And so the problem here is, if we look at the numerics, and if we do the same, exactly the same numerical operation twice, and then apply this non-deterministic reduction operation, is that the same numerical operation might yield slightly different scores. And this can cause bugs because, if you do the same numerical operations twice, for example, if you have tested some tree that didn't work well or that didn't improve the likelihood, and then have to roll back, this can really cause a problem. And this causes numerical bugs, which are very, very hard to detect. Okay. Another issue is thread pinning. Perhaps, let me just look at the time. I will skip that part. I'll just tell you a little bit about the test systems we use to figure out how those different parallel programming paradigms scale and work on the different systems. So we had the IBM Blue Gene, distributed memory machine, slow processors, very fast, low latency interconnect, the SGI RTX 4700, this is a shared memory machine with a fast interconnect, but also fast CPUs. So this has 256, we used up to 256 cores. Then we used a kind of standard Linux cluster with 32 four-way shared memory machines, single cores, and a very low latency InfiniBand interconnect, so fast network. And some of the emerging multi-core architectures, so the AMD Barcelona system, the Intel Clarton system, and the Sun X4600. Some test data sets here. So the first number just always refers to the number of tags in the tree. The second number to the number of base pairs, so just the alignment length, essentially just the length of the for loops we have parallelized. So we just used some different test data sets. So one important thing here is, if we look at those two data sets, 50 taxa, 50,000 base pairs, 500 taxa, 5,000 base pairs, here the difference in the computation to communication ratio is about 100 times less favorable in this alignment here. So what you have to think about is then we just parallelize those for loops and we execute those for loops many, many times in the way we traverse the trees. So we have many synchronization points essentially at every inner node of the tree. And so what happens here is that in a 500 taxon tree, I have 500, well, I have 10 times more nodes, more inner nodes than in a 50 taxon tree, more or less, which means that I have 10 times more synchronization points in there, just to compute the likelihood for this tree once. In addition, the for loops are 10 times shorter here than here, so I have 5,000 base pairs compared to 50,000 base pairs, which means that I also have to synchronize 10 times more frequently, or I cannot really profit that much from doing those for loops in parallel. Okay, so here are just some speed-up plots, number of threads, the speed-up here for P-threads and OpenMP-based parallelizations on this Sun multi-core system. And what you can see here, so this is just the linear speed-up, this black line here. What you can see here is that both P-threads and OpenMP scale very nicely on those machines. And actually, we achieve superlinear speed-ups, right? So theoretically, this is not possible, but this is due to computer architecture issues. Essentially, this means that per core, due to the parallelization, we have reduced the memory footprint, which in turn means a lower number of cache misses per core. And that's where this superlinear speed-up comes from. An interesting thing here to see here is that the performance decreases here, and this is just the case for the OpenMP-based parallelization of this more communication-intensive data set with 500 taxa and 5,000 base pairs. So on the AMD Barcelona system, this looks similar. There's no really huge difference between the OpenMP and P-threads-based versions. Once again, we can achieve superlinear speedups up to 8 cores. Actually, here in this case, the OpenMP-based version yields slightly better performance than the P-threads-based version. Okay, so now this is a completely different architecture. This cluster with fast interconnect. So that here we just use a distributed memory programming paradigm. And as you can see here, all three programming paradigms, so P-threads, OpenMP, and MPI, scale equally well. But of course, since this is kind of a mixed architecture, we can use MPI to really scale it on a larger number of processors, whereas with P-threads and OpenMP, we're essentially limited to just do computations on one single node of this cluster. So here is another slide, or here's another speed-up plot that shows you that OpenMP somehow breaks down on this SGI RTX shared memory machine. So speedups here are significantly worse compared to the pthreads-based version and the MPI-based version. But the MPI-based version here actually is implemented such as to use the shared memory as a means of communication. So this is not really on a network. But the MPI also communicates via shared memory. Okay. So, well, here's another speed-up on the cluster. So finally, I just wanted to show you the speed-up for a very large data set, evidently, and a very long data set, evidently, because otherwise it doesn't scale. On the IBM Lejeune machine, so this here you can see that we achieve a speed-up of around 890 for 1,024 CPUs, which is a pretty good value. Okay, so our conclusions on programming paradigms are basically that we want to use MPI and pthreads. Well, the bad thing is that on the one hand we have more programming overhead, on the other hand we have more control over what the machine is doing. We can enforce data locality with pthreads for NUMA and MPI. Evidently, we need that for distributed memory machines. And also, this is portable to the BlueJean and to clusters of SMPs. Whereas a pure shared memory approach would not be portable to distributed memory architectures. So one argument to do that is that we really implement this very simple, relatively complicated parallelization just once, and then use a generic interface to either access the pthreads or MPI communication primitives. Another thing is that, well, we haven't achieved optimal performance yet with the pthreads-based version, so this can be further optimized. And as I said, since it's easy to compile, biologists actually start to use this parallel version now. Okay, I will just skip all of this and come to an end. So just summarize some future challenges for the area of file informatics. So with respect to high-performance computing, we have two challenges. One is just to handle the constantly growing alignment sizes. For example, there was one paper in Nature in early 2008 that broad phylogenomic sampling improves the resolution of the animal tree of life. So currently, the first author of this paper is already working on a data set that is 10 to 20 times larger than what he published earlier this year. Another big challenge is to really efficiently exploit multi-core architectures or map the maximum likelihood function to multi-core architectures. And if we look at algorithms, one big challenge is to simultaneously compute and rapidly compute very good scoring maximum likelihood trees and support values, and to solve the problems I addressed in the very beginning that regard phylogenetic classification, in particular with respect to this data flood that is now coming at us due to the new pyrosequencing techniques. So this is something that will definitely need parallelizations and actually needs to be parallelized now. With respect to models, we need to adapt our models, improve our models to handle multi-gene alignments. There's a lot of discussion going on right now, but really no good solution. And, well, you know, we need to enhance our models by some kind of structure information to augment the input data we're using to improve accuracy. With respect to algorithms and models, our plan is to work on simultaneous alignment and tree building, which goes back to the initial question, what a good multiple sequence alignment is. So what we want to do is to optimize both the alignment and the tree consistently under the maximum likelihood model. This is a big challenge. So we don't know if this will work. And so one vision for the future would be that we want to have a simultaneous computation just by one program, efficient, in parallel, and so on and so forth. So just given some sequences, we want to simultaneously compute the alignment, the tree, the ancestral states, which people are also often interested in, and the support values. Okay. So finally, some acknowledgments. Most of the high-performance computing-related part has been done with Mike Lodge, who's a PhD student at the Technical University of Munich. And so if some of your friends are interested, I have two PhD positions available in this broader research area, the lab I'm currently trying to set up in Munich. And, well, so I almost finished in time, 1 minute late. So with this nice winter image from the island of Crete, I'd like to thank you for your attention and be glad to answer your questions.
Вопросы? Окей. Я...
Yeah.
Please explain once more what do you mean?
By phylogenetic classification?
Yeah.
Okay, let me just get some other slides. I think this is easier to explain like that. Okay. Okay, perhaps let me go a little bit further. What I mean is that we have a number of query sequences, right? So like 454 reads from pyrosequencing sequencing data. And essentially phylogenetic classification means that we have this reference tree which is shown here in black, and we want to assign the query sequences which are unknown and unidentified with some measure of support, so those are the support values here, to some parts of the tree. So, for example, if we have computed those statistics here in this way here, so we just place the query sequences into the phylogenetic tree as some kind of multiplications here. And so what we want to do, if we compute support values, so this is also a procedure based on the bootstrap, is to say, you know, that if I look at query sequence number 0 here, I have 100% support for the placement of query sequence 1 into this part, into this subtree here of the phylogenetic tree. And this will help people to identify, to find out what the things are that they find in those microbial communities, for example. So that's what I mean with phylogenetic classification. And from my point of view, this is a better approach, doing it in this way, than just trying to reconstruct a comprehensive phylogenetic tree for the reference sequences plus the query sequences, so to compute a fully resolved tree. Because the problem is, especially if you look at the bacterial people, that we have already very large data sets, single gene data sets, but with 1,000 or 2,000 or 3,000 sequences. And so this means that we have many, many sequences, but not really much data, because it's just the length of the 16S gene normally. So that's why I'm saying that this method, since we're anyway only interested in classifying those query sequences phylogenetically, is a better way to go. And so the thing here with the alignment is that actually what I'm proposing to do is to make a dynamic alignment of the query sequences during the insertion to the reference tree. So, for example, if I have the reference tree with those sequences here located at the tip, and I have the query sequence AG here, instead of just doing some kind of initial step and using a fixed alignment, I will just dynamically align the query sequence to the tree, to the signal I get from the evolutionary tree when I insert it here. So I do it here, here, then here I will get another alignment. So essentially for every query sequence, I consider a dynamic alignment of the query sequence with respect to the evolutionary history and the position in the tree. Do the same thing here. And also, when I look at the middle, if I really use maximum likelihood to do this alignment, I can make a distinction between this potential alignment here and this potential alignment here. Because I have additional information like branch lengths and rate heterogeneity, which also is taken into account during the alignment process. So that's what I mean by phylogenetic classification, which is different from the phylogenetic reconstruction problem that actually is just, you know, taking an alignment and infer the maximum likelihood tree for that. Okay. Sorry, very long explanation, but...
Okay, any more questions? Okay, I should to thank Alexandros for his lecture. What we do the next, I think that we should not start at 5 o'clock our closing our closing ceremony. Maybe at 6 o'clock, and we will have beer, we need time to prepare some CDs, and I suggest you to have a coffee and to have some relaxation, and then at 6 o'clock we will have the closing ceremony, and of course the presentation, making some ratings, and we have some presents for best presentations and other things. Okay.
Согласны все? В 6 часов мы здесь собираемся, пока здесь можно отдохнуть. Что? Ага.
Мы все побежали, сейчас вам сам.
Yes, yes.
Probably I could give you my email.
No, you know what? You can just send me an email and I can send you the reference. So honestly, I never really looked in detail at this paper. I just know that it exists, but I don't really know what they propose in detail. But some, you know, some kind of easier method to... easier to compute method, not to for non-time reversal. So just send me an email and I'll find the reference for you right away.
Thank you very much.
Sure.